ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Jake Adelstein first arrived in Tokyo 30 years ago. Back then, he found a cheap room to rent in a Zen temple and was studying Japanese. To everyone's surprise, including his own, Jake then got a job at a big daily newspaper, and before too long, he started covering crime. In Japan, this meant that Jake got to know all about the Yakuza, the organised crime gangs which at their height in the 1980s had 80,000 members and a semi-official status that made them almost untouchable. A story Jake wrote put him on the wrong side of one of the most powerful Yakuza bosses in the country, but he found friends and protection in some surprising places. During the earthquake and tsunami disaster of 2011, Jake saw another side to the Yakuza. He witnessed them as first responders, driving right into the radioactive zone to deliver food and organise shelter when everyone else was doing their best to escape. Jake's first book, Tokyo Vice, has been made into a TV series. His new book is called Tokyo Noir, and it charts some of the changes in Jake's own life over the last few years. I spoke with Jake Adelstein at the recent Sydney Writers Festival. So, can you tell on the street if someone is a member of the Yakuza?
If they're covered in tattoos and they're missing a finger, probably. In the old days, they used to wear like the badges of the gang on their lapel, so if you look closely, you would know. And if you wanted to be sure, then you could ask them and they would give you their business card. But those days are kind of gone. Or they stopped making this one around 2018. If you were like me, you could buy one of the Yakuza fanzines, which had the big members on the cover. And inside there would be little photo shoots of the monthly meeting of like the Yamaguchi-gumi or the Inagawa Kai. So you could learn to spot them like celebrities.
This is a hard thing for us to get our heads around, I think. So they're criminal but legal at the same time, or were?
They're still legal. I mean, it is not illegal to be a member of the Yakuza. When we say Yakuza, that's kind of a misnomer. You're talking about 20 different criminal organizations, each with its own history, its own leaders, its own fortes, and each group is divided into many subgroups. So, for example, I'll give names to him because these are the big three. There's the Yamaguchi-gumi, which is headquartered in Kobe. They have a huge fortress in Kobe. It's like a city block. You can see it on Google Maps. You can look it up on, you know, either in the Yakuza fanzine or the National Police Agency webpage of Japan. They used to actually have a Halloween party for the local kids. I knew an Indian family in the neighborhood, and sometimes I would go with them and sort of pose as an uncle. I think after a while they knew who I was, but that was okay. You know, just as long as we kept that pretext. There's the Inagawa Kai, which at its height had about 10,000 members. Their headquarters in Tokyo are located across from the Ritz-Carlton, Tokyo, so if you want to walk over there, you can. And then there's the Sumiyoshi Kai, that's the third largest group. They have their headquarters in Ginza under the name Hama Enterprise. I don't suggest that you go knock on their door.
So is it a mix of legal enterprises and an underworld, or is it not that clear?
It's a mixture of legal and illegal enterprises, and there are, traditionally and historically, there have been Yakuza who have legitimate businesses and illegitimate businesses. They claim to be Ninkyo Dantai, which I could loosely translate as humanitarian organizations like the Boy Scouts, and therefore they have every right to exist as an organization. And for many years, they were very much tolerated in Japanese society. And so you have this sort of weird things like there's a movie called Yamaguchi-gumi Sandaime, like the third generation leader of the Yamaguchi-gumi, in which Takakura Ken, who was like a huge film star in Japan, played Taoka-san, who is the third generation leader of the Yamaguchi-gumi, and he came and visited the set. That's very strange. I mean, it gets very surreal, but there's a retired Yakuza I quite like named Takigaki Satoru-san. He retired from the Yakuza and runs a nonprofit organization which is trying to rehabilitate the Yakuza. And he is someone who started playing Yakuza in movies and then became a Yakuza.
So when did these criminal organizations in this sort of form first appear in Japan?
I mean, you know, there's sort of the invented history of the Yakuza which traces them back to firefighters in the Edo period, but really The first Yakuza group that fits the Mallorcan category was the Aizuko Tetsukai in Kyoto about 1870. And so there was a time when they were sort of divided into street merchants, which were called tekiya, and bakuto, which were gamblers. And, you know, basically, in the old days, their bread and butter was protection, racketeering, and providing places to gamble, and then running little festivals and stuff in the neighborhood, and traveling merchants.
And what about in the wake of the Second World War and the sort of chaos and destruction in Japan at that point? What did that mean for the Yakuza?
Well, there was a period of time when the war ended, and Japan had a lot of what were called third-party nationals, which were basically the Koreans and the Chinese and the Taiwanese who'd been brought to Japan as slave labor. And when the Allies took over, the Japanese police were told, you can't touch these people. And after years of suffering under Japanese oppression, they basically, because they also had access to the bases, which the Japanese didn't, they ran the black markets, they formed their own gangs, and they sort of terrorized the people that had enslaved them. And the Yakuza sort of came back and became sort of a secondary police force for a short period of time. So when the police were actually empowered to police everyone again, they kind of gave the Yakuza some leeway, like, oh, you guys, you know, you held down the fort while we were reinventing the police force, so we'll sort of look the other way to what you're doing. And as long as you keep organized crime organized and you're not involved in street crime, we'll just let you do your thing.
You mentioned the Boy Scouts. Are there certain sorts of values or principles that the Yakuza imagine themselves as being upholders of?
Well, I mean, you know, they'll always tell you what we're about, you know, fighting the strong and protecting the weak, and not bothering civilians. It's never really been true, but that's the party line. Most organizations, the Inagawa Kai in particular, have a sort of set of rules which are often written on the wall when you go into the office. And you know, the things that are forbidden is you can't steal, you can't rob. Of course, sexual assault, that's not acceptable either. Ostensibly,
this is cutting out a lot of crimes.
Well, ostensibly, you're not supposed to use or sell drugs. And those are the things that are forbidden. So that's street crime, right? You know, you're not going to get mugged. You're not going to get robbed. You're not going to break into your house. They're not going to sexually assault you. And supposed to not be selling you drugs. But the other things like extortion and blackmail, that's acceptable. And if you ask why is blackmail acceptable, because the Yakuza answer will be, if you've done something so bad that the Yakuza can blackmail you, then that's social justice.
You mentioned the missing finger, which is an image of the Yakuza. What's that about?
Well, traditionally, when swordsmanship was an important thing, if you screwed up as a Yakuza and you cut off your part of your pinky and you offer it up to the boss as a sign of atonement, then you're weaker. You know, like a dog showing its neck. And that shows you're very, very sorry. Now, you can't tell when you look at someone's missing finger why they did that. But in the world of the Yakuza, they make a distinction. So when you chop off your finger because of your own screw-up, that's called a shinyubi. It's a dead finger because it's your fault. But if you chop off the finger for you, like your brother or your brother in the organization, so to speak, because they've screwed up and you don't want them killed or you don't want them to be kicked out of the organization, then that's a noble act, and that's called an ikkyubi, which is a living finger. And because it turns out that, you know, the world of the Yakuza is like a giant junior high school, everybody knows, you know, which finger it is. I mean, it's not just the fanzines, but people in rival organizations send each other New Year's cards. You know, they go to each other's wedding, you know, they go to maybe the weddings and funerals, and so there's a kind of like cross relationships between all these groups. And about 30% of the Yakuza are Korean Japanese. Another 30% of Burakumin, which is sort of the outcast class. So there's, you know, this level of communication that transcends party lines, which is kind of interesting.
As a tourist to Japan, I think what most Australians notice is that lack of street crime, of how incredibly safe it feels as an outsider. But, you know, there's obviously this other world that outsiders are kind of oblivious to most of the time. What were your first impressions, Jake, when you arrived in Japan 3 decades or so ago?
Well, my impression was, when I first got to Japan, it was just, you could read books. You know, this is the pre-internet age, right? I mean, I read books and magazine articles and stuff, but, you know, and maybe I sort of had this Kyoto image, but when you arrive in Tokyo, it's just this cacophony of sounds and signs and loud. I mean, it's, you know, it hasn't improved. Tokyo is very loud, especially when you do understand what they're saying. It's like 1,000 different voices telling you to, like, don't step on the wrong side of the tracks, watch out for the car that's coming, and don't get pickpocketed. It's constant barrage of sound. But you know, I never felt that I was unsafe.
You'd grown up on a farm in the Midwest, in Missouri. How had you ended up in Tokyo in the first place?
Well, I had an opportunity to study abroad in Japan at the University of Missouri, and that year I was the only one that applied, so they had to let me go.
Tell me how you found out about that opportunity in the first place.
Well, so I was walking through the University of Missouri campus, which has a wonderful school of journalism. Actually, this is a kind of a funny story. Well, it may not be funny depending upon how your views of journalism are, but when the local paper wrote up a sort of review of Tokyo Vice, they wrote, like, Jake Adelstein, who has grown up in Columbia, Missouri, never attended the journalism school here, because if he had, he wouldn't have broken all the precepts that journalists follow. He slept with sources. He blackmailed detectives. He rummaged through garbage for information. And I remember reading that and thinking, am I doing something wrong? But anyway, back to the University of Missouri, where I never went to journalism school. The study in Japan program fire hit me in the face, like on a windy day. And I remember exactly where I was, because there used to be McDonald's there, and I used to really like to eat the Filet-O-Fish. I mean, I am from the Midwest. And I was trying to decide, will I go eat the Filet-O-Fish, or will I go, you know, follow this thing that's hit me in the face and ask about the study abroad program? So I decided to skip lunch and go see what it was all about.
Were you already learning the language?
I was. I started karate in high school out of necessity, because I got bullied a lot. And also there was an incident in class where I got in a fight, and my teacher let me off the hook with the provision that I learned to channel my anger. So, you know, faced with like being expelled from school versus enrolling in karate school, I was like, okay, I'll enroll in karate school. So, you know, I was studying Japanese, and I was like, you know, halfway through the first year of Japanese course. I didn't have an aptitude for it. I wasn't the worst in my class, but I wasn't good. I can kind of remember my epiphany about Japanese language. It was at one point, I was like, oh, everything's backwards. It's like the end of the sentence, you know, determines whether you're saying something positive or negating something. And in a society where, you know, offending someone can result in you having your head lopped off, it makes sense that at the very end you can turn what was like, you know, a sentence of like, you're the stupidest person in the world, not. you know, it makes sense to have the verb at the end. You know, at that point, like, Japanese made sense to me.
Japan's a country, and I guess even more so maybe in the 1980s and 90s, where foreigners can go and kind of reinvent themselves. It lets Westerners do that, adopt a different sort of persona or character almost. When you look back at young you, were you doing that?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think we don't see the world as it is. We see the world as we expect it to be. So the problem with staying in your own hometown is you may, you know, mature. You may become wiser. You may grow as a person. You know, your personality may change. But everyone sees you as they expect to see you. So it's very hard to escape that preconception and become who you want to be or become someone else, because they just remember as the guy that got their nose caught in an elevator or something. And I think, you know, not just Japan, but in many places, going away gives you a chance to start afresh. Now, I mean, I think I'm misquoting Lao Tzu, or I'm quoting Harry Chapin, I can't remember which one. But, you know, you can go 1,000 miles and stay just where you are, but, you know, at least you have that chance to go somewhere where nobody has an idea of who you are, so maybe you can become the person that you want to be. And Japan definitely offers that. And, you know, during a period of time when foreigners were rare, if you were a little bilingual, you had a lot of opportunities open to you if you were willing to learn the language.
How did you end up living in a Zen temple when you were studying in Japan?
I I was getting a ginger ale at like 3 in the morning, and this English teacher like sort of ran into me on his bicycle, and after apologizing, we were chatting, he was like, oh, I've got this, you know. He was kind of running an English school, and he was saying, I've got this Zen Buddhist priest as a student who I don't have time to study. Would you like to take over? Because you're a student, and I'll introduce you, and you just have to pay me a commission. I mean, and I thought the commission thing's kind of dodgy, but I was like, okay, you know, I mean, maybe that's the Japanese way. So he introduced me to the Zen Buddhist priest, who was Ryogen, and we studied English. Like, we did a couple of lessons, and he was very nice. And I guess you would call him my Zen master. I don't know a better word. But after a few sessions, he's like, you know, I really don't have the time to learn English, but I see that you are a student and you're serious about your studies and interested in Japan, and if we have a room that's meant for a monk, but no one wants to be a monk because Japan is, you know, in the middle of its huge economic bubble. So if you would like to live there, you can live there, and in exchange, you can help out at the temple sometimes, and you'll have to agree to come to Zazen every Sunday and keep your hair short, and you can't have women in your room after 5.
And you were willing to sign up to these three requirements.
And it was great, and it was cheap. I mean, it was wonderful, a wonderful experience. Also, there was no shower and no bath, so I had to use the public bath, or I had to use what was called a coin shower, which was like a row of stalls. You know, this is very old Japan, where you could put in 100 yen and you get 5 minutes of hot water. So even now, I can't take a shower longer than 5 minutes because I start fumbling for the 100 yen coin.
How did you go about getting your first job in a newspaper in Japan?
Well, I don't know what the Australian model is for newspapers.
Not good.
But in the United States, typically, you work for a local newspaper, and then you build up your clippings, and then you go to the New York Times or the Washington Post or whatever newspaper still exists. But in Japan, the model is that you have national newspapers like the Mainichi, the Asahi, the Yomiuri, and Sankei. And they have 3 page or 4 pages of local news. So everybody applies to the big ones, and then they send you out to the local bureaus to earn your stripes. So it's kind of like a combination of national and local, but you start at the top. And all of them have standardized exams. So I had my last year of college, I had a job promised to me at Sony. So I had sort of job security, and I was like, well, if I don't push myself, I won't study hard. So I was writing for the school newspaper in Japanese, and very, you know, and I pity my editor, who later also became a reporter. And I was like, well, all my classmates are preparing for these examinations, so I will do the same thing. So I took a course in writing essays for these exams, and I bought some textbooks, and I worked through them on my own, and that was my goal. So to my surprise, I made it to the last interviews for Kyoto Tsushin, which is kind of like the Associated Press of, or the Reuters of Tokyo. I didn't get the job there. And the Yomiuri Shimbun, I took their examination, and, you know, the topic for the essay was Gaikokujin, like, which foreigners. And, you know, and I mean, I had written on that before, and I don't have a photographic memory, but I have a weird knack of remembering, like, what my articles look like when they've been corrected. So I was like, oh, well, this is my lucky day, because I'll just copy from my mind the correct version of this essay. And even though I missed a page because I just didn't think of turning over the back of the test, I still did well enough to get to the next round of interviews.
Were there many other foreigners working at the newspaper?
No. I mean, when I walked in to take the test, people looked like, excuse me, sir, like, where are you? And I'm like, you know, they were quite confused. And I said, like, here's my, you know, I have applied to take this examination. Here's my test number. And they were like, okay. And certainly someone noticed.
The fact that you were an outsider in such an obvious way, once you started writing on crime, was that almost an advantage that you could move between different groups, between police, detectives and criminals and gang members, because you were an outsider to every one of them?
Well, first of all, you're memorable, right? Because there's only one of you. I mean, it's also kind of a problem because people know your name, but you don't necessarily know their name. What I discovered after spending some time writing about the Yakuza, and I think there's a misconception that I've always, like, maybe the TV series made that even more so, that I've been fascinated by the Yakuza. Like, I wanted to go to Japan and write about the Yakuza. I think the Hollywood Reporter, which I don't have a very high opinion of, wrote recently that Jake Adelstein moved to Japan in the 90s to write about the Yakuza. And I'm like, no, I moved there in 1988 and I had, you know, no intention of writing about Yakuza. But you get assigned. That's your beat. In 1994, my second year on the job, after covering a serial killer who had actually killed the Yakuza boss, you know, I got assigned to that. And the interesting thing I realized about the Yakuza is when my boss assigned me, like, okay, you're going to be covering organized crime. I was like, why me? And he's like, well, 30% of the Yakuza are Koreans. Like, they're foreigners. And they look like they're Japanese, but they're not. And like, you're a foreigner, and you'll fit in well. And then when I started talking to the Yakuza, I realized that he was, you know, actually Korean, or had Korean ancestry. It was kind of like, I'd be like, you know, like, hey, you, I'm Jewish, and you're Korean. But like, we're kind of the same, because like, I look like I'm white. You know, like, I fit in American society, but I'm not the same. Like, you know, I have to deal with subtle discrimination. It's the same with you. You guys. And you get blamed for everything that goes wrong in Japan. So you're like the Jews of Japan, and I'm a Jew. So like, we're on the same team. And they're like, oh yeah, yeah, like you, me, brothers. And that worked to my advantage.
One man who came to play a big role on your reporting on the Yakuza was Tadamasa Goto. What sort of figure was he in his heyday?
I mean, kind of like a homicidal Richard Branson. And at one time, he was the largest shareholder of Japan Airlines. I mean, very powerful, very smart. You know, I have, because this is someone I researched and someone I know a lot about, because I've written stories about him, I also have this treasure trove of police files about him that were leaked onto the internet in 2007 by a police officer who was downloading porn and uploaded the entire database of organized crime on there. So, I mean, I know his passport numbers. I know all of his mistresses, one of them very well. So I know a lot about him. You know, I have the National Police Agency report on his entire life and how he works, how he used the media to achieve what he wanted. And he's a very, very, when you read the list of people that, you know, were under his thumb or that he had power over through blackmail or information, it's impressive, including Soka Gakkai, which is one of the largest religious groups in Japan, which also has its own political party. And he was their guy on the ground when they had a scandal that they wanted to go away. He was the one that did it. I think that one of his men attacked a local who was protesting against Soka Gakkai buying property there with a bulldozer.
And he was in charge of the biggest Yakuza gang in Japan at the time.
He was in charge of one faction of the Yamaguchi-gumi. So the Yamaguchi-gumi, which is like the Goldman Sachs of organized crime in Japan, the largest, always the largest and most powerful. There was an agreement that they would stay out of Tokyo. So he spearheaded the kind of like secret invasion, if it was like a Marvel Comics, like secret invasion of Tokyo. And that was him. He was setting the basis. He was taking control of the entertainment industry, investment companies. Really, you have to admire his business sense.
And what did you do back in 2008 to really piss him off?
He made a deal to get into the United States to get a liver transplant because he was dying of liver disease, and he ratted out all his Yakuza buddies. Now, I don't blame the FBI for making this deal because the National Police Agency wasn't very cooperative with him. And in order to track the Yakuza in your own country, you need not to just know their names, you have to have the kanji. Because there are lots of Japanese names that are the same, so you have to know their kanji, you have to know their date of birth, you know, pictures, all these things. And so he offered this up to the United States in exchange for a visa to UCLA to get a liver transplant. Now, the operation and the transplant, the FBI didn't have anything to do with. He made that arrangement on his own, and also three other Yakuza got liver transplants at UCLA. They all seemed to jump to the top of the line as soon as they arrived.
And how did he react to the news of this liver transplant, and more particularly the ratting out on his on his buddies. How did he receive the news of that being made public?
Well, I was contacted by someone in the National Police Agency, and they said, you need to come in and we need to talk to you because apparently there's a contract out on you. And I was like, that's not good. But, I mean, I realized that when you dig into something, he's not stupid, that he was probably well aware that I was looking into this problem because I'd looked into it before. And then maybe I should have quit, but I mean, I just, you know, it was just when that data leak happened in 2007, and suddenly I had his passport number, and suddenly I was able to piece together, because there were rumors that he'd gotten liver transplant in the United States. I was like, well, how can I not?
Podcast, broadcast, and online. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
You got a smile, like, here telling me this story, but you had two little kids at the time. Like, were you scared? Were you scared for your family?
Yeah, of course I'm scared. I'm not stupid. I mean, there's a difference between being brave and being stupid. But also because I understood how this guy works is, you know, you can't run. The only thing you can do is try and figure out, okay, he clearly doesn't want this written, so you have to get it written somewhere. And then there's, you know, this Yakuza axiom, which is the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And he wasn't well-liked within his own organization. So I figured that the best move to make would be to talk to his rival within the organization who had the reputation of being a gentleman. And so I basically went to his rival and I said, like, hey, did you know that Tadamasu Goto, who I know you don't have a very high opinion of, ratted you and a whole bunch of Yakuza out so he could get a liver transplant in the United States? And was this condoned at the top level? I mean, is sharing information about your operations and your members with the FBI a cool thing to do? Like, was this approved at the top ranks? And the reaction was very much like, oh. You know, like this kind of like long pause. And my feeling was, which Japanese we call the sontaku, was that our conversation was basically like, hey, here's a guy that you don't like who has territory and money that you would like to have. And if you can keep me alive, I will write this story, and then you will have a pretext to get rid of him. Can we make a deal? And so I didn't get a comment, but I did achieve what I wanted to do.
Well, let's talk about that, because Goto, after he was pushed out of his organization, partly because of what you had written, he wrote his own memoir that came out a year after your book, Tokyo Vice, did. Why did you start getting phone calls about that book?
Because there's this passage in the book where he refers to me, I mean, without naming me, in the same way he referred to Itami Juzo, the film director that was stabbed by Goto's men after making a comedy about the Yakuza, which is a great movie, actually. It's called Minbo no Onna in Japanese. He used the word fuyukai in his book and justified attacking the director. And then he used the same term towards me. And then there's this passage in the book where he writes, and it's kind of a strange book where he writes, like, I never met this reporter, but if I did, he'd be really sorry I met him. Ha, ha, ha. And so I was under police protection at the time, and the police officer said, this is a threat to you. And I said, it obviously is a threat to me, and obviously you could read this as an invitation to take me out and be rewarded. Unfortunately, the text actually says ha 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 after that, so he could say it's a joke.
It's like what you were saying about Japanese. You can just put that thing at the end and it changes the whole sentence.
Yeah, it changes everything. Just kidding. Yeah. So I went to an ex-prosecutor named Igari Toshiro, who is actually probably responsible for the eventual demise of the Yakuza. He sort of crafted the critical legislation and the ideas that have forced them out of business. And I said, I am bothered by this book, and I would like the publisher to issue a correction, and I'd like to sue. You know, it's not about money, but I do want this passage taken out, or at least clarified. It is defamatory. And he said, I'll take the case. And so, you know, he met with me. He was coming back to Japan from a trip, and we met, and he took my case, and then 3 weeks later, he was dead.
And it was meant to look, it was looked like an apparent suicide.
It was meant to look like a suicide, but someone in the Philippine police gave me an autopsy and they concluded it wasn't a suicide. They don't know why he died, but definitely not suicide. And before he passed, he told the editor of his book, which was published posthumously, that I may not be alive to see this published. And he sort of wrote a preface to the book, assuming that that would happen. So I never understood, was he killed? What happened to him? And no one did, but he certainly knew that he was in trouble.
This man was a real mentor to you throughout your crime reporting in Japan, and a friend, someone you admired.
He was a great guy. He kind of looked like a bulldog. But, you know, most prosecutors, a lot of prosecutors, when they quit being prosecutors, they go to work for the Yakuza because the money is so good.
They work for the Yakuza?
They work for the Yakuza. Because if you know how to prosecute them, you also know how to get them off. They're referred to as Yameken Bengoshi, like prosecutors who quit and became lawyers. In Japanese, it sounds really concise. But instead of doing that, he became a lawyer that fought the Yakuza. And actually, if you want to explain that, the beginning of the end of the Yakuza, it starts with my least favorite Yakuza, Goto Tadamasa. So the Westin Hotel in Tokyo used to be like, you know, the IT hotel around 2000 near Ebisu. And so Goto would stay there with his, but his goons would always come. And, you know, and after a while, they would sort of hang out in the lobby and intimidate everyone and scare them. And, you know, the manager of the hotel, who was nearing retirement, decided that the last thing he was going to do was get Goto to not come to the hotel anymore. So he went up to his room and he basically said, please leave, and prostrated himself before Goto and said, you're making people uncomfortable. We would like you to leave. And Goto was like, why should I have to leave? And he asked the manager, like, bring me the rules of the hotel. So when you sign into a hotel in Japan, and actually many hotels, if you actually sign in, there's a bunch of things that you agree to. And, you know, and so Goto said, like, there's nothing in this contract that says organized crime members are forbidden. So I have every right to be here, and you can't kick me out. But eventually the guy would not leave. And so Goto gave in. He said, all right, I'll leave. But he left behind a deposit of like $10,000. And so the hotel was like, oh my God, what are we like? We've got a $10,000 deposit left here. Like, nobody wants to go bring it back to him. Because like maybe he'll say, like, you're insulting me and demand compensation. And he's a scary guy, right? So they had Igari-san come and handle the money. So he handled the returning of the money. And then he realized after hearing the story, like, well, what if you put in the contract, we refuse the right to deal with organized crime members? By signing this, you certified, I am not a member of an organized crime organization, nor do I have an association with them, nor am I working with them. That became called the Organized Crime Exclusionary Clause. So everything you sign in Japan, if you sign a sports club, if you sign up for a bank account, if you sign up for a cell phone, it has that clause in there. And if you are a Yakuza and you sign it, you know, with your four fingers, you've committed fraud and you can be arrested. And you'll spend 23 days in jail. You know, maybe the prosecution won't take the case, but you're just going to go to jail for 23 days. And years later, when the Tokyo police finally felt that we were sick of the Yakuza, so we want to get rid of them, I mean, the National Police Agency, what they did is they turned that clause into an ordinance. And an ordinance is not a very weak law. You know, you can only put people in jail for a couple, maybe a year or longer. You fine them a lot of money. But his idea became the basis of the organized crime exclusionary ordinances. And I don't know if this is actually like subversion or not, but the National Police Agency and the cops realized they would never get a national law on the books that would make it illegal to do business with the Yakuza. So prefecture by prefecture, and Japan has 47 prefectures, just like Australia has many like city states. It took them 2 years, but finally by October 1st of 2011, every single prefecture has one of these laws on the books, these ordinances. And what the ordinances say, almost universally, and there's variations by prefectures, you cannot do business with the Yakuza. You cannot give them money. You cannot pay them protection. If you are paying them protection money, you are a criminal. And then there are penalties which are either time in prison or a fine. And that combined with the organized crime exclusionary clauses and contracts has made it very difficult to be a yakuza because you can't rent an apartment, you can't get a cell phone, you can't have a bank account. And that all begins with Goto Tadamasa at the Westin Hotel.
Who is presumably killed by Goto's man at some point while he just after he's taken on your case. What about Goto? Is he still around the place?
He is still alive. A couple years ago, he financed the film about his life called Budai. It hasn't been released. I know someone who saw the film of it. It's supposedly not a bad Yakuza film. He fled to Cambodia at one point after agreeing to pay the family of a man that his men killed about $1.2 million, which shows that, you know, you can't get away with murder. It's just very expensive.
Although, obviously, these contract laws, these ordinances have changed the way the Yakuza are operating in Japan, I want you to tell the story of the quite incredible role they had in the 2011 disaster. You weren't in Japan when that earthquake and tsunami happened.
No, I was not in Japan.
Yeah.
I was actually at a Yakuza film festival in New York City. And I was talking to one of my bosses on the phone. He was up in like this corporate tower, and he remarked the fact that the building was shaking, and it was like, it's really shaking. I said, you know, you should probably get off the phone and get out of the building. So I didn't make it back. So I'm trapped in the United States trying to get back to Japan.
Why were you so keen to get back? Because that was a point where it was really, you know, was it going to be like flying into Chernobyl? What was driving you to go back to Japan?
First of all, I had a house and I was sharing it with some people. So I had my roommates there. My driver and bodyguard was there. My close friends were there.
It was home.
It was home.
So describe flying into Tokyo a week or so after that disaster. What could you see from the plane?
Well, I think that Tokyo Electric Power Company had convinced the world that, you know, by shutting down a few nuclear reactors, Japan wouldn't have any power. So everything was powered down. So the city, you know, there were like no lights on. It looked like, you know, like little pockets of fireflies as you're flying into the city. The plane was almost empty. I took like three suitcases with me full of like toilet paper and supplies and water and ramen and things, because I knew that the Yakuza were taking stuff to the disaster area and doing it more efficiently than the Japanese government.
So is this a role they'd played in other disasters?
Yeah, I mean, if you claim to be a humanitarian organization, sometimes you have to do humanitarian work. And the nice thing about, I mean, you know, the good thing about the Yakuza, in the sense, is there's institutional memory. Like most Japanese, you know, I've talked with this with people at the Federal Emergency Management Agency several times. In Japanese bureaucracies, people rotate through positions very fast. And they do that so that people don't get, it's to prevent corruption. But the result is you have nobody who's been in the same position for a long time. So no one remembers what to do if there's a disaster. Everybody's starting over again. Maybe if you're lucky, you get someone who's on their third year at the time. But the Yakuza, it's the same people year after year. So they know what to do. And there's no red tape. It's like, okay, well, you know, get the trucks. You know, like one of those businesses that we bankrupted, like take all their inventory, pay them something for it, take it to the scene. You know, they know exactly what to do. They've got their own trucking system. They've got their own front companies.
And I guess they've got a lot of labor.
Yeah. And of course, you know, and it's like, okay, you're going to go into the nuclear contaminated area, take some iodine pills.
So they're actually driving into those areas.
And while I was in the United States, the Daily Beast contacted me and was like, we'd love for you to write something about the disaster. And I said, well, I'm not there, but I do know that the Yakuza are bringing food and aid to the thing, and that's an interesting story. They did the same thing after the Kobe earthquake. And my editor is skeptical, of course. And I'm like, okay. So I had, you know, some, I don't want to call them friends, people I know in the Yakuza, in the Yamaguchi-gumi and the Inagawa-kai and Sumiyoshi-kai, send me photos and videos of them unloading stuff. And like, receipts. The person from the Yamaguchi-gumi sent me like a sort of itemized list. And I was like, okay. I sent it all in and I wrote the story. I wanted to call it Yakuza to the Rescue or something. I forget what the original title was. And it was true. They were very good. They were very good at responding.
And what did local people think about this?
Local people are just like, I want hot food. I want a blanket. They were fine with it. In 2011, it's still the Yakuza didn't have that the image they have now of just being the scum of the earth. There was still a kind of like noble outlaw image. And of course, for them, right, it's incredibly good PR. They want, I wouldn't say they were craving for it to be reported, because they also realized that with the current shift in the way the laws are and stuff, that it could be problematic for the people receiving goods from the Yakuza. But I think they were happy that it was written up. And for me, in that world, the side benefit of that was, especially when, like, I think this Yakuza fanzine basically rewrote my article and introduced me as, like, the person who wrote about this, is that I got a reputation as being fair. I'm like, oh, Adelstein. You know, it's like, kibishiki no. It's like, you know, oh, he's hard on us, but at least he recognizes that we have some a social function. So that made life much easier for me, because I wouldn't say that I became like a hero, but I became like, oh, that weird gaijin reporter who wrote about the good stuff that we do.
As you came to learn more about what had happened, particularly at Fukushima and the nuclear reactor, who did you end up as seeing really as a bigger criminal involved in this story than anyone connected with the Yakuza?
Oh, the biggest criminal in the story of Fukushima is Tokyo Electric Power Company, the management, and the Liberal Democratic Party, which turned a blind eye to the problems at the nuclear plants that they'd known about for ages.
So the way sometimes was reported here was, oh, this was just a natural disaster out of anyone's hands. What a horrible, terrible, unpredictable thing.
No. The Fukushima nuclear reactor in particular was very old and antiquated. There was a wonderful book written about it called The Dark Empire, which pointed out the problems there. There was a Yakuza who had blackmailed Tokyo Electric Power Company about cracks in the fissures, and they paid him off. That's well documented. And the real problem was, and TEPCO covered this up as best as they could, is it wasn't the scenario of like the tsunami came in and it knocked out the electrical power, and that's why you had this unavoidable, unforeseeable disaster. I don't think people remember it now, but at the time, TEPCO insisted we had no knowledge, we had no indication this could ever happen. It was beyond our realm of comprehension, when actually they had a full report warning them of the dangers of a flood knocking out the power, which resulted in a nuclear power disaster. But what really happened in one of the reactors, it only takes one, is the earthquake itself broke all the pipes, because it's a 40-year-old reactor. All the coolant leaked out. They couldn't cool the reactor. The meltdown started right as soon as the earthquake happened. It was the earthquake itself which knocked out one of the reactors. And by ignoring that fact, the new regulations they have, which are supposed to make the nuclear power plant safe, aren't safe, because they don't take into account the possibility that an earthquake alone could cause a meltdown.
So it's still a risk of something of that scale happening again in Japan is very alive.
I can guarantee you, if they continue to open nuclear reactors, especially the ones that are over 40 years old, there will be a nuclear accident again. I mean, they're still dumping contaminated water from the Fukushima reactor site into the ocean now, and they will be for the next 40 years.
We've talked about some of the changes with the Yakuza. I want to finish by just hearing some of the changes that have happened in your life, Jay, because you were approaching 50, had something of a midlife crisis, and thinking, how much longer do I want to be reporting on these guys? What else can I be doing with my time? And who did you go and have a cup of tea with?
Well, I was actually working on a story about a French pastry company in Japan where one of the chefs worked himself to death. Karoshi is the term in Japan for death by overwork. And so someone had given me this great story about this very famous French company where this baker had worked to death. I went to the funeral of the guy, and it was a Zen Buddhist funeral, and I wanted an introduction to the priest so that I could go talk to the family so I could write the story. So I went to my Zen master, Ryogen, and we were having this long chat about life and work, and he's always been very straightforward with me, and he sort of said in Japanese, more or less, like, it's great work what you do, but maybe it's time to stop being a daredevil man whore and follow the noble path. And I thought, oh, you know, that's not a bad idea. And then we had a long discussion. It's like, can you be a journalist and a Zen Buddhist priest? Because, you know, one of the precepts that you have to take as a priest is you can't talk badly about other people. And he was like, oh, if you're writing the truth, that's not talking badly. That's just the truth. So he had like, you know, everything I brought up, he had an answer to. And it turned out that his most convincing point was, he said, you know, first of all, I don't have a son. And unfortunately, you're the only student I have. You're the closest I have to disciple. And we were discussing when we would do this, and I said, well, we could do it on my birthday, which is March 28th. And he said, you know, that's amazing. Like, that's the day I became a Buddhist priest. And I kind of, like, cocked my head, like, sort of like, BS. And he went and he brought his, like, album of him taking his Buddhist priest vows. And I looked at the date of the album, and it's all black and white, and it was 1969, March 28th. And I was like, oh, you became a Zen Buddhist priest on the day I was born. And he was like, no, you were born on the day that I became a Zen Buddhist priest, so this is fate. And so I he convinced me to take the vows, and so I have been training ever since. But if I don't move up in rank within the next 3 years, I get kicked out.
So you've ordained as a Zen priest?
I am registered. Registered would be the word.
And what will that mean in terms of the different work opportunities that come your way?
Technically, I could do weddings, but I'm not really fond of the gold-pointed hat. As a Zen Buddhist priest, you can run a temple, you can counsel people, you can do grief counseling. One of the things I really like that we do every year is something called Osegaki, which is this ceremony to exorcise hungry ghosts. So if you feel like there's a loved one in your life who hasn't moved on and they're haunting you, or they're sort of can't move on to the next realm, I can do that ceremony and we can help move them to the next life.
Are any of your old pals or contacts in the Yakuza interested in this new role of yours?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're like, great, because there's so many people that won't do funerals for Yakuza anymore. So, to be honest, I keep sort of putting off learning the funeral rites because I'm like, I'm not there yet.
There is so much more in these books, as I think you've just got a little sense of the tip of the iceberg of the worlds that Jake has uncovered. Please join me in thanking him. Jake Adelstein was my guest on Conversations today. Jake's books include Tokyo Vice, which is now a TV series, and his new one, Tokyo Noir. And I was speaking with Jake at the recent Sydney Writers' Festival. And a big thanks to all the organisers of Sydney Writers' Festival for making that possible. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.